I'm here with Jay Livingston from Montclair State University. Jay runs the Montclair Socio blog. It's at Montclair Soci, so soci.blogspot.com. How long have you been blogging, Jay?
Since 2000, let's see, September 2006, so 12 and a half years.
You got to be one of the longest sociology blogs going.
I think so. I mean, I looked at all the others that I noted and bookmarked along the way. And a lot of those people, I mean, the good people, Gabriel and Tina Fetner and Jeremy Fries and Chris Eugen, and they were good people. And they stopped. I think Fabio is probably the most consistent. And I'm not sure when he started org theory.
I remember seeing your blog in grad school, though, like... You know, so it's an institution in the, I guess, in digital sociology. But we had a great exchange about a bit we did earlier on the Annex about Eric Kleinenberg, loneliness and living alone. And what I enjoyed about it is Jay's been in the business a long time. And I guess you've been there long enough so that what we think is fresh and new, you can see like the old wine in new bottles. And I just love that aspect of it. So let's set up the story and then we'll get into it. So Jay was blogging on that same conversation about loneliness, which I guess was initially generated by a New York Times story by David Brooks or?
No, Arthur Brooks.
Arthur Brooks. Okay. Do you want to give a summary of it just to set the stage?
Well, yeah, Arthur Brooks, who is, the Times has two conservative columnists, one who's on salary, David Brooks, and then the other who contributes once a month or so, Arthur Brooks from the American Enterprise Institute. And Arthur Brooks had a column, and I can't remember the exact title, but either the title or in it appeared the phrase epidemic of loneliness. And he was basing it on some report from Cigna that came out saying that some, like over half of the country was lonely. And my first thought was, yeah, we've been here before, and especially I was thinking the guy who has really done the debunking of this loneliness, because it crops up regularly, and the guy who goes to the data and looks and debunks it is Claude Fisher at Berkeley. And so I read it and I thought, oh, wait till Claude sees this, if he hasn't already. And then I waited for him to write about it in his blog, which is called Made in America. And he didn't, so I blogged something about it. But to the idea that we keep getting these reports about an epidemic of loneliness and that Americans are lonelier now. And it is true that people are lonely, although after the Cigna report, another Pew came out with something like the figure was around 10%. But whatever it is, the chances are it hasn't increased all that much over the last several decades, at least, maybe longer ago than that. And so I started wondering, well, why is this myth so persistent? What is the appeal of this myth? And that reminded me of another myth that I blogged about within the first, I think, 6 months that I was doing the blog back in 2006 or seven. And that was the myth of the authoritarian past.
So which one's that? I don't remember that.
Well, there is, you hear, it's frequent to hear people complain about kids these days that they don't listen to their parents and, and several times since I've been writing the blog, I'm just reminded of that song from Bye Bye Birdie, kids, what the heck is wrong with these kids today? Kids, they are disobedient, disrespectful oafs and whiny and lazy. And that song, that show began, opened in 1960. So it's really in 1950s. So if people were making that complaint about kids in the 50s, that for parents in the 50s, that their parents were much more authoritarian and kids listened to their parents. And then we've had this same thing, like every generation you hear this, people complaining about, oh, well, I was a kid, or, you know, you look at some kid and say, well, gee, I could never get away with that with my old man.
Right. And, oh, I remember the articles about how Generation X doesn't want to work.
Oh, and, yeah. yeah. Well, that has a lot more to do with labor market forces. But anyway,
yeah.
I thought, well, what is the appeal of this? Where does the sense of the authoritarian past? Because obviously each generation couldn't be less and less authoritarian, because we long ago would have hit the zero authoritarianness thing, right? We're at the asymptote. And so I remember this cartoon. It's a great cartoon. I wish I had a copy. But it shows a father and son coming out of the house after a big snowstorm. Mm-hmm. And they're trudging through this high snow. And it's like up almost to the father's knees. Mm-hmm. And trudging behind him is his little son. And on the son, you know, it's up to his chest. And the father is holding his hand up to his chest, you know, parallel with the ground, saying, hey, this is nothing. When I was a kid, we had snow up to here.
Yeah, right.
and so I was thinking, it's the same thing with authoritarianism. That is, to the kid, the snow is up to here. So to a child, adults look very authoritarian and powerful and, you know, to be feared and so on, because they are. They're much bigger than a six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And so you remember parents, when you were a kid, they were much more powerful and such. And then you grow up to be an adult. Mm-hmm. And you realize that as an adult, no, you're not really all that powerful, that you have to, you know, make all kinds of compromises with the world and you're, you know, negotiating with the world in a number of ways, and that even your kids seem to you to be not all that commandable and so on.
Right. So it's like a perspective thing. It's like it's a perspective thing, a coming of age type of.
Yeah, the analogy I used was from a discredited idea in evolution called ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is that the development of the fetus, it goes through the same stages as the evolution of the species.
Hmm.
So that the very early stages of the species look like the very early stages of the species when it was,
growing in utero.
The same thing with people. They assume that the development of me from being fearful of authority to me seeing adults with having no authority or little authority somehow recapitulates what's going on in the wider society, which is that the degree of authoritarianism has decreased.
Right.
When in fact it stays the same. Then you're right. It's a matter of perspective. From the kid's perspective, it looks like the world is authoritarian. And from when he grows up, it looks like not so authoritarian after all, but assumes that it's because the world has changed, not because he has changed.
Right. So it's another example of how we sort of have these perennial ideas of social trends where people feel like they're at the apex of some massive change, when in fact it's business as usual as it has always been.
Yeah. And so that even when there's no change for the society, there is change for the individual, because the individual is no longer a kid of 6 or 7. He's now a grown up of 36.
Right. And then they write about it, and all the other people who are turning however old and coming of age at the same time share it on Facebook, and thus a fad of thought.
Right. But you see this every generation, no matter how far you go back. And so I was thinking, well, that the myth of the authoritarian past is one that's particularly appealing to people who like authoritarianism and wish that things today were more authoritarian. And that leaves out us liberals. And so I was thinking, maybe it's the same appeal with the myth of the communitarian past, where nobody was lonely and life was more gemeinschaftlich. And I thought, well, maybe it's the same mechanism, because after all, when you're a kid, feelings matter a lot. You can be dependent on others. You have to be dependent on others, and others are reliably there to, to take care of your needs and your dependencies, and that the world is warm and interpersonal and so on. And then when you grow up, mm-hmm. then personal relations, those kinds of personal relations are not as intense, and there's a lot more, you know, call it gesellschaftlich kinds of relations that you are engaged in. Mm-hmm. And so you think, gee, you know, when I was a kid, people used to look out for one another and take care of one another and all that. And what
used to bowl in leagues and all that.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, they used to bowl together. And so I call it the myth of the communitarian past. And so you have these two parallel myths. One is the epidemic of loneliness, and its corollary is the decline of community.
That's interesting. It reminds me of the narrative of consumerism is quite similar, I think. For example, I remember reading a passage in Adam Smith's Moral Foundations where he talks about people who are lovers of toys and want to spend their money on ear pickers and are no longer content with the cottage of their father. You know, that's the late 18th century.
Well, the same thing. I think somebody, maybe Kieran or somebody, dug up a quote from some ancient Roman complaining about, you know, kids don't listen to their parents anymore the way we used to.
Oh, that's hilarious.
but in sociology, we have these books. And, you know, in the blog, I juxtapose three book covers. And one is The Lonely Crowd, great book, very important book from 1950. And then 1970, Philip Slater, The Pursuit of Loneliness, also a very good book. And then 30 years later, Bowling Alone, 2000, and all hitting on this same thing that we have a decline of community and an increase in isolation and loneliness. So I think it's what liberals want more of, just the same as conservatives want more authoritarianism. Liberals want more communitarianism. And so that goes hand in hand with being able to remember the old days as more communitarian.
And everybody looked out for each
other. Yeah. And what you're really doing is extrapolating from my life when I was a kid to the old days. Society has changed. Society hasn't changed. It's just that you're now an adult, and life for adults is not as communitarian as it is for children.
You know what I like about that whole take? It made me reflect on sort of just the craft of doing sociology, you know? And you like to think that we're a social science that's developing cumulative knowledge and, you know, advancing sort of pulling humanity's knowledge of how society works in some linear fashion where we don't go back. But when I was looking at your comparisons, boy, when you look at it through that type of perspective, it looks like we're basically, it's just an eternal quest to quash the easy tropes that seem to just come up every 20 to 30 years. It's just like it's an easy argument, sort of a nice intuitive argument that someone's going to like, and then it becomes sort of stale until everybody forgets about it, and then someone else resurrects it. You know, like John Kenneth Galbraith said, financial crises happen every 20 years, which is about how long you need for like a new crop of young people who didn't experience the last one to start getting some money.
Yes, except financial crises can actually be measured. And, you know, what Claude Fisher has tried to recreate is data which would show whether there actually is a loneliness crisis in a way that or epidemic in a way that there hasn't been in the past, and you can't find it. So so what we're reproducing is the same story, but and it may be a good story, and it may be in some ways a true story, but it's not a new story, you know. And so to write about it as though it is new is to forget, you know, that the story has been written before.
So Jay, you've been in the business for a while, right? I don't want to, you've been in the business for a while. And is this how it's always been? It's basically, you know, people we're slinging stories, and it's not so much of a cumulative enterprise. Like, is this just something that you see after being in the business for, you know, a few decades? You're like, he's doing, he's resurrecting so-and-so, or he's doing this shtick, or...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, some ideas are just too appealing to let to let go of.
Die.
and because maybe there's something to him. You know, I think I wrote to you, the first time I wrote to you was about, I think you and Leslie and maybe Gabriel was in on it too, were bantering about medical sociology and ethnic differences in experiencing pain. I remember when I was, I guess, an undergraduate, we were exposed to this article by a guy named Borofsky writing exactly about that, that, you know, you go to the hospital and you can tell who are the Jews and who are the wasps and who are the Italians by the way they talk about the pain. It's probably, not as rigorous as research as we would do today, but, you know, it's an appealing idea that then became sort of a little, fell, I guess, out of favor, both in terms of ideology and maybe in terms of data, but you can see why it would keep coming back.
It's funny though. So it makes you feel as a sociologist like you're sort of on a hamster wheel. You know, like how there was, remember the Saturday morning cartoons where like they'd always defeat the bad guy, but you knew he'd be back next week and there was never any final solution to, you know, the eternal conflict. So these types of, you know, these types of recurrent tropes, I guess, is it just forever our duty to probe them every time they come up every 20 years to redispel them?
Or? Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting to look at the role of authoritarianism in in American life and especially American families. And it's true. I mean, because, you know, go back to de Tocqueville, probably earlier, certainly later, you know, through the 19th century, and visitors to America comment about how, well, they put it differently, you know, some think of it as the children's independence or liberty, or rudeness and ill-mannerness, you know, depending on the visitor's point of view. But they're observing the same thing, that American children are much more independent than European children. In the same way, loneliness is important, and if whether or not it's increasing, it is an aspect of our culture, and the concern with community is an aspect of our culture, even if it's not, you know, periodically reaching epidemic levels. It's still something that's, community is one of the basic sociological concepts that it's interesting to see how and where it is and what's going along with it.
That was Jay Livingston of Montclair State University. Jay has one of the longest running blogs in the discipline, Montclair Socio Blog. You can find it at Montclair Soci, that's SOCI.blogspot.com. Thank you for sitting down, Jay.
Okay, thanks a lot, Joe.